Hey, it's John Williams, and thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals. Please share it with your friends. Please give us a good rating. Funny I should ask that. This is going to be a weird edition of the Mincing Rascals. It's really good. It is very spirited. The problem is, after about 45 minutes, you'll notice a couple of little glitches. Some people's voices seem to be a little sped up. There's a couple of places where there's a jump. It's very brief. And then at about 50 minutes, when Eric Zorn says something profound about Major League Baseball and the voting laws in Georgia, cuts out. Damn it. So that's a computer issue here that the gerbils will fix next week. But you've got a real good, almost entirely full podcast coming your way with that little exception. Remember, good ratings, please. Here we go. Today is Thursday. It's April 8th, 2021. It's 1:38 in the afternoon. And hi again, it's John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast we record throughout Chicagoland. We've been doing this for about 5 years now. And you can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Eric Zorn, the controversial columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
You are in trouble. We're going to get to that in just a minute. One of my colleagues at the radio station, by the way, today pointed out he saw a statistic, 26% of all podcasts issue one podcast, and then they don't do another one. I was thinking, I don't know the start date of the Mincing Rascals, but I know that we preceded Donald Trump by about a year. So I'm figuring we're a good 5+ years. I don't tend to count episodes or shows that I broadcast. Some people announce every day on the radio how many shows they've done.
I thought you were going to say that you were going to claim responsibility for his election. That's what you're about to say.
You know, we've talked a little bit about this, I think, Lisa. I didn't think he was going to win the primary. I was incredulous when people were saying, oh, no, this guy might win the primary. And I said, there's no way in hell that's going to happen. I thought I was on such safe, smart ground.
Well, I was one of the people who thought when he started doing well in the early primaries that it was kind of good news, that it showed the Republican Party in a lot of disarray and that they might even nominate this clown, in which case Hillary Clinton would win 50 states. So
this should have been a one podcast podcast. We didn't know what the hell we were talking about.
My crystal ball for Trump has been so poor all along. Yeah. I really hesitate even to speculate as to what's going to happen with him going forward. So
I do think the temperature on the planet is a lot lower, though, both that he's not president and that he's not on Twitter. If there was a barometer for the mental health of the world, don't you think it'd be down 50%, something like that?
I have that sense. Yeah,
I think among Democrats, maybe.
I guess so. Although I would guess also that even the people, I don't know if you can be neutral about the following, but don't you think regardless of what side the line you're on, you know the temperature's down. Like that was your guy and you wish he was president. You don't like Joe Biden and he's a liar. But you got to admit that the pressure is down. The temperature is down. Let's start with this, you guys. Two cars on northbound Lakeshore Drive got into a gunfight on Tuesday. A 21-month-old in one of the vehicles was shot in the temple. That child has survived so far. Police have arrested and charged the boy's driver, who also was engaged in the gunfire. I don't know much more about the person that shot the child. Am I right on the news on that so far?
43-year-old man.
Yeah.
Who is reportedly the boyfriend of the child's grandmother. She was the one in the car who got out after the shooting with the child.
Yeah.
And was looking for help right there by Grant Park.
Do we know whether the people in the cars knew each other beforehand, or this somebody cut somebody off and they went nuts?
I mean, the mayor said it was just road rage. She said that the initial investigation was that it was just, as she put it, simple, stupid road rage. So there's no indication that there's a pre-existing relationship between the occupants of the two cars.
How is this story different? We've had carjackings, we have gun violence, we have mass shootings, we have random shootings. This one, it seems to strike a different chord. I guess maybe some of the answers to that question are obvious, maybe not all of them.
Well, just that it's a one-year-old is really what brings this to the top of the news. If this had just been a bunch of adults shooting at each other, it would have been a short story on the TV news and might not have even made the papers. And it's indicative of, just as you said, how prevalent guns are out there and how I mean, I think it makes sense at this point as you go through life when you're having a confrontation with someone to think that there's a decent chance that they're armed. And if they are armed, there's a decent chance that they won't show a lot of restraint.
I saw a statistic.
I think it would have been a story because it happened near downtown. But I think that it heightens it with it with a child
yes.
being shot. I think some of the commentary I've heard, opinions I've heard, was sort of like, how could the person inside the car with the baby, you know, open fire? There's as much sort of shock about that as sort mm-hmm. of somebody shooting into just the shooting back and forth. It goes to sort of the beliefs that if you have a gun in hand, you're going to go to that first to solve conflict. And then it goes to sort of some of the other issues at hand. Why are people feeling this need to sort of be armed in the first place? What's going on there? I see that the child's condition has improved. So I'm hoping that goes up and up and up.
I was thinking about, so obviously this is sample size of one. You know, it's not like there's a wave of Lakeshore Drive shootings, but I was reminded immediately about, you know, Lisa's comments about the insanity of driving on Lakeshore Drive, which we've talked about before.
Yeah, recently.
And I was looking up one of the sort of underreported but interesting phenomenon in the wake of the pandemic has been nationally a massive increase in the number of tickets for speeding over 100 miles per hour. So if you search just, you know, Google News for tickets over 100 miles for speeding over 100 miles per hour increasing, you'll see places like in Kansas, it's up like 60%. In California, it's up 50, 60%. Across the country, there's this general mania, I guess would be one way to put it, on the roads during COVID. And it's not just restricted to driving, like homicides are up nationally a lot. Over 1 year. I think the latest numbers on that are somewhere around 20 to 30%. And I think it just speaks to the psychological trauma of the pandemic and people generally engaging in far more risky behavior.
Do you think some of that has to do too with sort of the roads being empty for so long that people
yes.
were able to use every single road as sort of a highway freeway? And now that sort of people are kind of coming back out, getting back out on the road, oh God, you know, here are all these people and they don't know how to drive.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
I wondered about that.
But I was just wondering if there are statistics on pedestrian deaths as well, because I hear those are up as well, which again, kind of doesn't make sense if we're quarantining at home and staying away from others. Pedestrian deaths would be up as well as homicides and some of these other crimes. It kind of doesn't add up.
I'd be curious as to what your experience has been, but I think walking generally in a lot of neighborhoods is actually up because people are taking walks at like times of the day they would not otherwise be walking. Saw way more people walking in 2020, at least where I live, than I did 2019.
And are they looking at their phones the whole time? I've noticed.
Oh, for sure.
So yeah. Maybe that's it.
Well, I think what Lisa's first point, though, about the location of it was a little startling, too. I think there's this sense that I can avoid some crime, but if it comes up Lakeshore Drive and they're randomly, well, these guys were targeting each other, but you could have been in the crossfire, you'd think Lakeshore Drive would at least be a safe place to be from bullets. And now bullets are whizzing past. You know, you thought all you had to do was worry about not getting carjacked in Chicago, and now this is just another layer of things to worry about as you sort of navigate 2021.
Well, that was also a criticism on my part. I didn't maybe state it as well, but, you know, if it happens sort of like in a, you know, well-to-do area, it's a stunner. If
yep.
it happens in some part of town where there is, you know, maybe more crime or parts of town that we ignore, it's not so much a big deal.
Don't you think also, though, that road rage is something that you can avoid? So if somebody cuts you off, it takes two to tango. If somebody cuts you off and it just infuriates you because they're a knucklehead and they're being aggressive and they're being the monster, don't you be the monster, too? I was reading some statistics about road rage. 2% of drivers say they have tried to force another driver off the road. The incidents of somebody demonstrating road rage behavior, they have probably done it 27 more times, or at least people admit to on 27 occasions when they say they've been a road rager, say they've done it at least 27 times. So there are some people out there that are like these little driving time bombs Now look around, 100 cars on the Kennedy near you, two of them would happily run you off the road if you gave them the finger. And I never do that sort of thing. I think I'm going to be very circumspect going forward.
I won't even look at another driver. Like if you're going down one of these highways and somebody is too close to you or is riding right next to you, I never turn my head. You never know. People can take things wrong so quickly. And so many people have guns, and just keep looking at the road and going where you're going. And so far, so good.
Well,
sad commentary, but it's absolutely true.
Well, I've seen two strategies about that, Eric. One is that if there is a sort of disagreement about lane use, say, sometimes you should look at that person and personify your car. Show them that you're a person. Go, hey, I'm sorry. You know, throw them a shrug and a wave if that's appropriate. But then I've read other reporting that says, especially if you're going to react negatively, keep your eyes on the road. Don't engage or incite this person any further. I don't give people the finger, but I have been known to narrow a gap that somebody wants to get in.
That's a classic move. I respect that. People, you can't abide by cutters.
Somebody described for me the scene where there's two lanes of traffic, and then on the shoulder, it's a merge up ahead, so we're all going to zipper in, and then there's the shoulder where you could just kind of cut in line all the way down, and when you see those people coming, doesn't that just piss you off to no end? So some of us will go ahead and straddle that line so as to prevent somebody from using the shoulder as a freeway to the front. Probably a bad idea, too. It works, but how do you know that's not going to be the guy in the white Lincoln who would just assume shoot you?
That's it. I'm resuming my public transportation riding.
Well, don't do that. It's not safe.
Tell John tell you about his experiences on public transportation.
I rode the train again. I got back on that horse this week, Eric.
I didn't think it was so bad. I am going at times of the day where it's less busy. I'm not going, you know, just by chance, not because I'm trying not to, but I'm still working from home. So I've gone sort of during off times, and it's been fine. People are wearing their masks.
Yeah.
Everyone kind of looks at each other, kind of circumspect. Are we sitting, you know, far enough apart? But it's been fine.
Every red line train I've been on still smells like pot, but it has seemed a little safer since I got on there.
What's a little pot? It's legal.
I know. That's actually... you guys have noticed this at all? There are times where we're driving down Lakeshore Drive or wherever in the city, and the town smells like pot. And I'm thinking, that can't be true. That must be me, but I'm not making that up. I'm like, where is this coming from? Do we have a marijuana cloud hanging over our city?
I noticed it before it was legal, too. I'd be waiting for the bus on Michigan Avenue outside the Tribune Tower. There'd be people just walking by, or driving by, and they were smoking pot in the car. I mean, people,
Let's talk a little bit about the Derek Chauvin trial, the former Minneapolis police officer accused of killing George Floyd. I guess that's the way to put it. It's not murder yet. Maybe the defense says he didn't even lead to George Floyd's death. George Floyd had enough drugs in his system that he died while Officer Chauvin was trying to arrest him. It's been interesting to watch the defense. The prosecution is making its case here, but the defense seems to be focusing on two things. Again, they haven't had their day to present yet, but they are saying that the drugs in George Floyd's system were enough to perhaps cause his death, and that the knee wasn't on his neck the whole time anyway. There were injuries to the shoulder and back. And they're also saying that the growing crowd was getting loud and violent enough that it might have been difficult for the officer to do his job. He may have behaved in ways that he would not have otherwise. Lisa, I know you've been following this. I think all of us have watched it fairly closely here. What are you making of the case so far?
Two things. I think that in meeting each of the sort of the key players, the folks who are outside of that store on the stand after seeing them, and I didn't think they were doing anything but being sort of insistent that Officer Chauvin sort of pull back, get off of George Floyd. And in meeting them, they were sort of the same people. Like, look, you know, we're trying to get him to sort of relent and get off this guy. He's saying he can't breathe. And we're right there. It's just common sense.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's icing on the cake, but I do think probably the most damaging witness to the defense was the off-duty paramedic who was asking to you know, give him medical attention. She saw that he was in distress. George Floyd was in distress. She happens upon this scene. She is begging them. And the one officer, I can't remember his name now, tells her, if you're really a paramedic, get the F out of here and not interfere. They are all trying to sort of convince him to get off. And so I thought that was probably the most powerful part of the case. It seems to me it's going to be a hard one to come back from for the defense. We'll see.
This idea that if you put your knee on someone's neck and they happen to have some drugs in their system, or they have a heart condition or whatever, that those might have contributed to death, that doesn't seem like a winning argument to me. I mean, the question to me is, if they had handcuffed him and put him in the back seat of the squad car, would he have just died? Or did compressing his neck basically cause his death? I mean, because you're not going to get, like, every murder victim is not going to be a great physical specimen, right? I mean, they're going to have, like, oh, look, he was obese or he had a heart condition. Yeah, but you choked him to death. I find that line of defense curious, and I can't believe it'll be effective.
The other remarkable part of it, too, is to see this line of police officers, veteran police officers, high-ranking police officers, including the police chief, who is way back a source of mine when he was a district commander, take the stand and for the prosecution. That's something that we have not seen. And it's sort of difficult to sort of say, you know, there's always sort of this feeling in these cases where either you're pro-police or you're anti-police. Well, this is kind of taking some of that out of the conversation here. No, it's about good policing versus bad policing.
What struck me was that Dr. Martin Tobin of Loyola University was on the stand this afternoon on Thursday, and his testimony was very stark at that, you know, George Floyd did not die from a drug overdose, that he died because his neck was compressed, and that he actually testified that George Floyd died 3 minutes before Derek Chauvin removed his knee from his body, which is an interminable time if you think about it. So if any of our listeners want to dip into the trial, I was really struck by his testimony, which matched sort of a structural definition of sort of how our necks work and sort of how the air flows through, as well as really almost graphic testimony about how you can tell when George Floyd died because of the way the rest of his body reacted, that his leg kicks up at one point, which is he said was an involuntary reaction to the loss of oxygen, and as well as you can see him sort of, you know, struggling by trying to push himself up from the concrete by his knuckles and trying to lift his shoulders up. So as we tape this, the defense is cross-examining him, but I think that sort of detailed medical testimony combined with sort of the emotional weight that Lisa was describing, I think we haven't heard the defense's case, set a high burden for them.
Yeah, the most stunning thing to me, I agree with Lisa, was the parade of law enforcement officials. So not only the police chief, but I think the longest serving officer in the department, the commander of the training division at the time of George Floyd's death, all testified for the prosecution. And that's extremely rare. I've also never seen that before in a case to this extent. And the collectivism of police unions is as strong as any other institution. And the fact that they broke that wall or the blue line is really commendable on their behalf or on their part.
The police department, as I understand it, has 4 or 5 phases of readiness there in Minneapolis, and that there are 2,000 or 3,000 National Guardsmen and women on standby for different parts of the trial. There was a Twins game at home today in Minneapolis, so they were a little more ready for who knows what would be going on or around the courthouse. And Lord knows when the verdict is read, all mayhem could break out, both in Minneapolis and Chicago. I wonder, I guess, if the police testimony that we're hearing is anticipating how badly things could go if Chauvin is found not guilty, and if they're trying to also demonstrate that the police force is not the bad guys here. They thought Chauvin should have gone to jail too.
I would hope that, you know, the threat of mob violence or civil unrest is not the only motivating factor for police to to call out people in their profession who have acted poorly. And I think if that were the case, that would reflect badly for everyone, people in favor of police reform, people against it.
Yeah.
It speaks to Lisa's point, which is that police should be the ones leading on this issue, because it's in their interest to do interest to do so for their profession.
Ross makes a good point about that. You want the police to be showing some strength, and also I think the defense made a point early on. They tried to get the trial moved out of Minneapolis because there was some sort of sense that maybe people on the jury would say, well, we've got to vote to convict him, because if we don't, then there'll be, Rodney King style riots or a replay of last summer. We don't want that. So in the interest of public safety and peace, we will find him guilty. That was rejected by the judge, as I recall, I think there certainly is going to be a concern. There's always a concern about this. And this case was such a flashpoint last summer, even after arrests were made fairly quickly. It was still, the anger was still quite strong, quite high. From everything I've seen, this case should resolve in a guilty verdict of some sort. And I do fear, and I would certainly seem like I would understand the anger if they were to find him not guilty.
Or guilty of just manslaughter. That was a point Darlene Glanton made with us last week. What if it is just the lesser of charges? Well, that seems sufficient. Do you all have any understanding of how true the idea is that a person, if they're on methamphetamine or fentanyl, develops superhuman strength? They can be so wildly uncontrollable that we have to use extraordinary force. Is that true? And in the case of George Floyd, where he's handcuffed and on his stomach, how relevant is that notion? Do you guys have any thoughts or information about that kind of thing?
I mean, it's certainly something that we hear from police departments all the time when they confront suspects that result in the use of force. We heard that in the Laquan McDonald case, right? They said, well, he was on PCP, so, Jason Van Dyke had no choice. But of course, that wasn't borne out by the video, which led to Jason Van Dyke's ultimate conviction. The other point that the police chief made was that even if George Floyd had been actively resisting, which it's clear from the video he was not, even in those cases, the what Derek Chauvin did was out of the department's protocol, that those techniques that he used were never approved for use under any circumstances, which I think is something important to keep in mind as we all sort of sort through the, well, what did the police do and why did they do it? Under no circumstances does the Minneapolis Police Department say, officers, this is a technique you can use under these certain circumstances. So even if George Floyd was acting much different than we know that he was, there's nothing in that rule book that says that what Derek Chauvin did was appropriate under the department's rules.
But did you describe Floyd as uncooperative or cooperative? I think there's plenty of instances where you could look at that video and say this guy did not cooperate.
Sure. I think uncooperative and actively resisting are two different things.
Well, he didn't want to get in the back of the squad
right,
car.
Right.
He has
claustrophobia.
Claustrophobia. But otherwise, he wasn't. Once he was on the ground, I don't think he was fighting, was he? I haven't.
Right.
I didn't understand the nature of the struggle on the ground. He was saying mama, and he was almost saying goodbye to his family. He said he was going to die. He said he can't breathe. There was a discussion about whether or not he said, I ate the drugs or I don't take drugs, was a point of contention the other day. I was reminded in a strange sort of way of that incident when the Chicago Police Department struggled with that man in the subway. There's just a level of competence with an unruly suspect. What do we do with this person? And George Floyd is not a small guy.
I was thinking of the Red Line Station incident,
yeah,
too, but in the sense that it was such a display of lack of physical awareness and control of your own body as a law enforcement officer. And if you talk to anyone who's done any kind of like mixed martial arts or karate or jujitsu, rolled around in a jujitsu gym, they'll tell you how to safely subdue a person. And the ways that you saw, in that Red Line Station, the fumbling, bumbling of these two officers trying to get someone under control, and then Chauvin using this completely absurd technique that I don't think really any true law enforcement professionals think of as a good idea for how to subdue someone. it does speak to incompetence, I think.
Yeah. Well, not to mention that we know, based on reporting from the Sun-Times, that those officers are the subject of at least a federal subpoena, if not a full federal investigation, for their conduct at the Red Line station. So that is certainly not something that I would point to as an example of, you know, appropriate use of force by a law enforcement officer, since it's triggered all sorts of investigations. And those cops, I believe, were placed on leave and are still under COPPA investigation, as well as potentially a federal investigation.
It's sort of unbelievable, given that the officer, one of the officers, fired at the man as he was running up the stairs.
Up the stairs, in the case of the Red Line incident. Yeah, yeah.
And struck him, I believe, in the leg or the buttocks or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just, and the thing is that because the guy didn't die, and I don't even think he was hospitalized for that long, that story kind of went away. It fell right off the radar screen. Imagine if that shot had been a couple inches higher and had paralyzed or killed him.
Well, at this point, somebody needs to say something like, none of us are police officers. Thank God those people are out there doing the work. Not all officers are that way. Walk a mile in their shoes. I mean, I hear that, and that's very true. But I think you can have a conversation like this without indicting police everywhere. You can talk about those specific instances and say that was incompetent, or that was, I don't know what the motivation was for Officer Chauvin at that time, except that he had some young officers with him. The look on his face was smug. It's like, we get to do this. I get to do this. We're the law. Here's how you do this. It was almost like a kind of training exercise where he didn't even seem to care that that was a human being under his knee.
I also wondered if you ever could sit down with somebody, you know, like him and get into their brain. Did you not want to sort of feel like you were giving into the crowd?
I think that's a fair question. The officer's a human being too. I don't think those people are immune to some of that kind of social pressure on a scene like that. That makes sense to me. I mean, it shouldn't override his actions, but maybe that was a factor in his behavior.
Right, but it gets to the big picture of what we were even talking about in the road rage, right? There's sort of a way to interact with people who are resisting. I always wonder, I've covered police long enough, I've always wondered in these situations whether, okay, you're concerned about somebody. Is there any way to sort of, if you think they're going to be violent, arrest them? Either sit down in a chair or something and sort of cool off, and then sort of come together and talk. What's going on? Interview them. You know, what are you doing? What's going on? In a case like the George Floyd arrest, I guess I'm saying, not if somebody's sort of holding people hostage. I don't mean that. But
right. Maybe because he was on the drugs, he was not capable of that kind of conversation. But some sort of de-escalation.
Some cooling off period.
Yes, absolutely. Austin, Heather, what does the city of Chicago do about de-escalation techniques these days?
Well, that's an interesting point, because the consent decree requires police officers to now be trained on de-escalation techniques. I think the issue is that work is not completed, and that while those policies might be in place, they are either not fully implemented or haven't been fully reviewed by the federal court. Police officers under state law have the absolute right to defend themselves against a reasonable fear of force. And that overrides any requirement for de-escalation. And that's why you had Jason Van Dyke arguing, I reasonably feared for my life, so I opened fire. And that, you know, justification defense has been found to be extremely wide ranging. The hope is that if you train officers more, that if you increase their comfortableness with de-escalation techniques, that they will go there first as opposed to, you know, force.
Well, isn't that it? They need to want to do that, though. They need to want, you just get the feeling that this works too. And why do they have to play softball with this guy? I'm the law.
So I would encourage, I know it's probably daunting, but the consent decree is like 250 some pages, maybe 270 pages. And if you read that full decree, you will be shocked at what the police department is not doing, because the things it recommends are so common sense, are just so basic, that they find that the department isn't doing, whether it's training, whether it's like across the board. And one problem with implementing any of it is the fact that in Illinois, the collective bargaining agreement between government unions and the government will trump any law that's passed by the state. And these union leaders write the law. The reform has been slow, one, just because of managerial failure by the Chicago Police Department and the mayor's office, but also because of structural reasons at the state level.
I was really struck by what Mayor Lightfoot said the morning after the latest monitoring report came out on the consent decree. And that report, that was not great by any stretch of the imagination. It was less bad than it has been, you know, before. So I guess that counts as progress. But Lightfoot basically said, look, it was clear before that we didn't have any buy-in from members of the police department. And now we are starting to get that. And I sort of did a blink and a deep breath, because this consent decree is 2 years old. This did not fall down yesterday. And if only 2 years in, we're getting to the point where maybe officers have stopped actively resisting its requirements, that's not great. It's because, like Austin said, these requirements in the consent decree, which the police department has not met, is basically like, consult members of the public before you adopt new policies. And they just have consistently not done that. And that's over and above a willingness to rethink how they approach people in a law enforcement context.
The idea behind a lot of these things in the consent decree is not just that it makes citizens safer, but that it makes citizens safer when you improve that relationship with police, you make police safer too. And you keep them from being in these situations where they're facing discipline or jail time for overstepping their bounds and for the kind of fraught situations that they do find themselves in. So the lack of progress on the consent decree is baffling on that level. You think the union would be behind more of it?
Yeah, one other shooting story. A 13-year-old, Adam Toledo, was shot by police in Chicago last week. There is video of the shooting, but we have not seen it yet. It took place at 2:30 in the morning. And Eric, you wrote a brave column about it this week. I'll just characterize it that way because I know it's generated a lot of buzz in town. Tell us the story, your take on it, and what happened since.
Well, my take on it is that it really is, unfortunately, we haven't seen the video. And so we don't really, and the police have been fairly vague about what happened. So we don't really know what happened here. They called it an armed confrontation with this 13-year-old boy and his 21-year-old companion in a little village alley in the middle of the night. And since we don't know, and there were, and it's kind of outrageous that we haven't seen the video and the police are not telling us more. But the point that I was making was that a lot of the people who are protesting this were making a really big deal out of Adam's age, 13, sort of to suggest that the police were out there just gunning down children for no reason and gratuitously shooting them. And one of the points in the column was that 13-year-olds, if you look through the headlines, are routinely charged with very serious crimes. And again, I said that this doesn't necessarily say anything about Adam here. Using this kid's age to sort of as a symbol for his innocence, any more than you would say that this woman's a grandmother, so she couldn't be a killer or something like that. And you know, the response to the column was huge, and all of it on Twitter just about was negative. But a lot of the email was positive, and Facebook was really mixed. And you know, in thinking it through, I think you know one of the mistakes that I made in writing it was that it had a really sort of cold, analytical tone that didn't really appreciate or honor the fact that no matter what happens to a 13-year-old kid, whether he's a choir boy or a gang member, whether he is out after midnight or walking home from school, if he's killed at age 13, that is a tragedy, and that is something that we need to acknowledge. And I feel like, you know, as I look back on the column, I can see why this almost Spockian analysis that I put forward didn't appreciate that, and so I took a lot of heat for it, and it's been interesting to say the least.
I make that mistake sometimes too. I say, well, here's my point, but boy, you got to meet people halfway. You should have peppered it. Hey, Eric, here's what you should have done. You should have said all of that stuff and then made that point.
I think Eric's core message in that piece, aside, you know, setting aside anything about recognizing the 13-year-old kid, as his death is a tragedy, is that So I've spoken, I'm not sure if you have, if any of you have spoken to people who've seen the video or seen the video themselves, but I've heard from multiple people that it's the moral valence of what happens in that video is inconclusive. I don't know if that's true, but say it is. Say the video is inconclusive about whether the officer acted wrongly or if the 13-year-old acted wrongly. It's critically important that in that context, people don't just apply prejudice and preconceived notions upon that situation. They should take time to think through it, to think through what's going through the kid's mind, through the officer's mind, and make a decision that way about what they think is right and wrong. And I think that that message is really important for people to hear, whether you're extremely pro-police or extremely anti-police.
Well, does the amount of time it's taking to see the video tell you something about how the police feel about the video?
Perhaps. I think it might, it could, but I'm not really privy to, it seems with these cases, every time there's the mayor's office comes out and says, we need transparency, we need to see the video. And then everybody's like, wait, we need to get legal review on the video. Like, can we release it? Can we not? And it's this dance where there seems to be a narrative from the mayor's office that the policy is really clear and all these videos are released. But then there's always some confusing circumstance where that isn't the case. Am I reading that wrong? Those of you who follow that more closely.
And I got to say, I find it suggestive to troubling that the video has not come out yet. This mm-hmm. shooting was a week ago Monday. So what is that, 13 days? Like 10, 12 days. It is time for them to get that video out and clarify what happened here. I have not heard much about the video, this delay is dismaying.
One of the things that I talk to a lot with the retired police officer is this issue of he's far enough away from this now that he wouldn't have any say. He was on the force for 25 years. He says that there's an ongoing concern about and talking to his old, coworkers about who is arriving in terms of law enforcement on these scenes. And then how did the people who saw these officers arriving on scene perceive it? And what I mean by that is, were they plain clothes? And so if they were plain clothes, did they announce themselves? And then does a 13-year-old even know that there's a possibility of having a plain clothes officer? And then, so that's where I kind of go back to the idea that sort of we don't need to, I don't think we need to be judging a 13-year-old in terms of whether they are good or they are bad. They are like every other human with lots of nuances. That's where, Eric, I got to say, that's where it kind of hit me hard. Your piece hit me hard, not in a good way either. I did think it was cold and hurtful.
I acknowledge that it was, like I said, the tone was just, it was, I felt, looking back on it, was too analytical. It's sort of saying like, hey, look, let's not judge either way on this case. And I think people wanted and they deserved more of an acknowledgement. This was, no matter what happened, it was a tragedy. And that thread was missing. And so it gave the piece. Now, you may have other problems with it. I don't know. But that was when I look back on it and thought, boy, if I had that to do over again, that's how I would change that piece. But,
well, there are instances where a 13-year-old holds a toy gun, points it at the police. This happened a few years ago.
In Cleveland.
Was it Cleveland, the one I'm thinking about?
He was like
about?
Eight, wasn't he?
And
I believe it was 12.
And think about the decision the officer has to make. Could an 8-year-old or a 13-year-old fire at a police officer? Sure, absolutely. So if the police officer's not knowing what to do, defend themselves, I mean, that's a possible scenario. Then while the age is galling and the circumstances aren't clear, I understand why the officer uses his service revolver in a case like that. Do we know if the child was armed with an operable firearm?
We do not. And I think that is part of the problem. And Mayor Lightfoot complicated that effort this week by saying repeatedly at a press conference that she wanted to see the adult who, quote, put the gun in Adam's hand end quote, arrested and prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Now, in that same press conference, she stood alongside Superintendent David Brown, who repeatedly declined to say whether Adam had a gun or not. It complicates the reporting as a reporter of this story. And it complicates the fact that there is an ongoing investigation, and ostensibly the administrator of COPA, the civilian office of police accountability, reports to the mayor. And if the mayor is already saying, hey, this kid has a gun, which would then lead to, a probable finding of justification by COPA, it's problematic. It's also problematic, I thought, that the mayor asked for privacy for Adam's mom, but then Alderman George Cardenas, who represents this area of the city, got up there and said that he didn't have anyone, that he was an abandoned child, and that he was, left on his own to fight the streets. And I think that was very, very hard to listen to, because I can't help but empathize with his mom. My oldest is almost 12. And I think that complicates this effort. The other thing that struck me is that police arrived at the scene where they had been called by reports of shots fired, just shots fired, nobody injured, nobody hurt, just the sound of gunfire. And 2 minutes later, Adam was dead. And that is an incredibly short period of time to figure out what's happening and to make a decision, and to make the kind of decision that resulted in the loss of the life of a child is hard to wrap my mind around, which is why I think we all want to see that video. In these cases, we all want to find a reason to say, this would not happen to my kid. This would not happen to my family. This wouldn't happen to anybody that I know. That is just a way to sort of let all of ourselves off the hook on this, rather than really sort of focusing on what happened to Adam and what happened to his family.
And Heather, I did pick up on that sort of back and forth. I'm like, oh, you're adding to this family's pain. The alderman may have meant that sort of he's the oldest of a big family. And so a little bit of me could relate to that. I'm one of eight kids myself. And I am a kid who I did sneak out sometimes. I know it's a different situation. When you're in a big family, and we were friends with other people who had big families, yeah, there isn't that sort of 24 hour, and it wasn't a time of helicoptering either with your kids. So you did get out and you did go do stuff, and thank God, nothing happened. To sort of say, oh, well, he shouldn't be out at 2:30 a.m. Well, plenty of kids zip out and get it into trouble. And but you can't sort of judge and say, okay, well, he didn't have anybody. Parents can't police everybody all the time when there's that big a crew.
And if you're out at 2:30 in the morning, it doesn't mean that whatever you're doing, you should get shot for, depending on what you're doing, I guess.
Obviously, it's breaking curfew is not a capital offense. And at 2:30 in the morning, your parents are probably asleep. So you might have just snuck out of the house. The impulse to blame the parents came through very strongly in an email that I received. People really were saying, like, let's.
Because I think that makes us all feel better. It makes us say, well, okay, obviously there's a reason for all of this. And it's not just this huge systemic unfairness and racism and a lack of resources that is ultimately responsible. And that if we can blame the mom or the dad or whoever, it lets us all collectively off the hook.
Well, I don't think it's a leap, though, to suggest that there's some lack of parental control here. I mean, let's look at what we're talking about.
I don't know anything about, not anywhere close enough to have any sort of opinion on whether, Adam's mom was a good mom or a bad mom, or she was a mom. There's no reason to think that a 13-year-old kid sneaking out of his house at 2:30 should be in any sort of mortal danger from an agent of the state.
I get that, but we're not speaking in a vacuum here.
I think we should speak in a vacuum, though, because I think that's the problem, is that if you sort of try to zoom out because it's too painful to focus on the fact that a 13-year-old boy is dead at the gun of a Chicago police officer, it makes it almost easier than just to focus on that. And you know, you can't tell me that if, you know, a white kid who lived in Lincoln Square had been reported missing, but then was back and then was reported missing again. There are so many more services and resources available to the average kid in those neighborhoods than there is in Little Village. I mean, the mayor's entire press conference was about the need for the police department to create a new policy for foot police, for foot pursuits, which has been in the consent decree, again, for 2 years, which has nothing to do with the individual, you know, not small tragedy of Adam's death. And that, I think, has gotten lost with all of this talk of who's at fault and who's responsible and who's not responsible. A boy is dead at the hand of a police officer.
This, to me, is what struck a chord with me about Eric's piece and why I think it was important. And it's that if you zoom out and everyone begins to graft on political lenses, ideological lenses, narratives of race, class, and morality onto this case without facts, it gets ugly. And it's disrespectful to that child and to their parent to do that and to graft those things onto this event before we know what happened.
Well, maybe it's not apples to apples, but doesn't that line of thought somewhat parallel the complicity of the adults driving the cars on Lakeshore Drive? Don't you, to some degree, say that child is not shot or injured or killed, but for the actions of some adults? They're the ones that are the safeguard for the kid. So the child had no responsibility on Lakeshore Drive. The adults were in charge. Shouldn't adults have been doing more to safeguard a 13-year-old at 2:30 in the morning, not in Lincoln Square or Lincoln Park, but on the south side of Chicago or whatever the exact address was of this? So I think that's where this is coming from. And I don't think that's a terribly racist or unfair observation to make.
I think it is somewhat unfair, because if my kid sneaks out of the house at 2:30, the chances of her coming in contact with an armed police officer is basically zero.
That's the point.
So that is a privilege my family enjoys that should be enjoyed by families across the universe or across the Chicagoland area. And I have done nothing to deserve that particular privilege except being wealthy and white. So we have to grapple with the fact that if a kid does something, makes a bad decision, does whatever, they are at much greater risk because of their race and socioeconomic status.
Okay.
And I don't think that's okay.
This will sound terrible, but were you to be living in the South Side and you were a more attentive parent, don't you think then you would have done more to safeguard your child into those circumstances?
So I think we'd like to tell ourselves that I would have been a better mom.
The impulse to blame the parents, which came through so strongly, really belies the fact that there's so much in the way of influences when you're looking at a particular situation of struggles that the children have, struggles that the parents have, the factors that are involved in the community, in the peer group. There are medical issues. There's often financial issues. All these things combine. And we all know, I believe, we all know really nice, you know, solid families that have kids that go wrong for one reason or another. And we also, you know kids that grow up in really tough situations who turn out great, that there's a certain amount of luck that goes on, and the judging parents, especially in an individual case like this, is I think really unfair and really harsh. I certainly don't in this case. This woman, you know, her kid disappeared or wasn't there at 2:30 in the morning, but what do you expect her to be sitting in a rocking chair outside his bedroom window, about his bedroom door every day? I think I agree with Heather here.
Mm-hmm. You sounded very confused to find yourself in that position there.
What's the consensus on the Major League Baseball All-Star Game going from Atlanta to, in this case, Colorado, because of the new voter laws in that state? Speaking of controversial columns, I have John Cass's piece from the Tribune about that, where he blames it, the poisoning of baseball, on Joe Biden, which is a take I didn't see coming. But Austin, let me just start with you. I know you're a St. Louis Cardinals baseball fan.
Well, as a Cardinals fan, imagine, what if that informed my view on this topic? there's a lot of tit for tat around the MLB's morality in making this decision. It's a big corporation. Of course, they're doing it because in some way there's a bottom line consideration there. You can go all day comparing what the specific voter regulations are between Colorado and Georgia. It's true that Colorado is generally more open of a state to vote in than Georgia. There are some specific areas of voting policy where it may not be. But I was struck particularly by the fact that Atlanta is the biggest Black metropolitan area in the country. 51% of the residents of that area are Black. It is the home of the highest number of Black business owners in the country. And they are all going to lose out on $100 million in business. Some of them were praying for that business and being kept open on the promise of that business. And the fact that they're punished by the actions of politicians, to me, is what is so unfair about all of this, to say nothing of the policy itself. But that's what I keep thinking about, is those people who stayed alive, their business stayed alive during the pandemic. They're hoping for a windfall from this great event, and it was taken away from them.
Do you have a view about the wisdom of the new voting laws in Georgia?
There's obviously, like there is with any change on a politically charged topic, hyperbole around the nature of those changes. Undoubtedly so. I think calling it Jim Crow 2.0 or the 21st century Jim Crow is irresponsible based on what that law is. In general, I think Republicans, unfortunately, have a strategy that goes beyond just making it easier to vote and hard to cheat. There are ways in which some of these voting laws are specifically designed to lower turnout in some ways under the guise of making it harder to cheat. There are also things that are extraordinarily popular among most Americans, like voter ID laws, that shouldn't be lumped in with, you know, shenanigans, you know, in other parts of the election law.
John Cass is ahistorical because back when the All-Star Game was supposed to be hosted in Phoenix, baseball pulled that from Phoenix because Arizona would not support a federal holiday for Martin Luther King Jr. So if you want to make an argument that this is all new and totally President Biden's fault, you're going to have to grapple with the historical record. And you're going to have to grapple with the historical fact that these sort of arguments, like the ones my esteemed colleague Austin just made, were the same ones that were used to oppose boycotts of apartheid and other oppressive regimes that we have seen time and again have resulted in political change. I don't think Cass's column holds any historical water. It doesn't illuminate anything that issue here.
The difference between this and apartheid is that you're moving resources literally from a 51% Black metropolis to a 7% Black metropolis. It's very clearly different.
I don't actually think it is, because what's interesting is that the Braves Stadium is not in Atlanta. It's in Cobb County, and they moved out of Atlanta to Cobb County because white Braves fans, and we're not even talking about the fact that that Braves is a, you know, ethnic slur against Native Americans. They moved out of Atlanta because their white fan base did not want to travel into majority Black Atlanta. So I am a little bit unsympathetic to this.
But there is an economic impact on the city of Atlanta. You can't say there's not an economic impact on the city of Atlanta.
But I am unsympathetic to the fact that this is somehow going to hurt the people that are also being hurt by efforts to suppress the vote in Georgia.
We did see quite a few especially after George Floyd's killing, a lot of athletes, African-American athletes, well, the whole rainbow, right? Go out, either join some of the marches or use their platforms to speak out against this. And so I think that it might have been a little bit more organic than people think. Maybe MLB is going with the flow and this is a good business decision. But I've got to believe that some of the athletes, also, as an NBA fan, I have to point out that didn't they pull out of the All-Star Game the NBA did back in 2016 or 2017 in Charlotte?
Yep.
When over the transgender bathroom law.
These laws, these changes were made in response to a great big lie.
See, I told you it would cut out at the very end. Darn it. We'll have to finish that part of the conversation next week and then move on to some new stuff. Thanks for listening to The Mincing Rascals. Again, do share it with your friends. We'd like to grow our little audience and community here. You can always email John Williams at WGNradio.com. We'd love your feedback. Thanks for finding The Rascals.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com.